than what you've given me the flattery and the honor and privilege of doing with you guys today. I want to tell you how much I have enjoyed it, how much fun I've had. What encouragement you've been to me. And when you can travel wherever you go, and you find family. You find family that's willing to take off from other things that are important and be together. And to share each other's strength and to supply each other's weakness. And you certainly have supplied mine. And I want to tell you from the very bottom of my heart, I really appreciate and thank you for letting me be part of this today. And what I will take back with me back home, the little piece of everybody here, a little piece of that encouragement, a piece of that hopefulness, that there are things in this life that go beyond this life. There are things that we can't see that are more powerful, more important than the things we can see. And while I will not be able to see you anymore when I come back, when I go back home, I will take with me that part of you that's far more powerful, the things of you that I can see. Your decency, your devotion, your faith, your goodness, your sense of what's truly important in life, that you would be here today to strengthen each other and encourage me. And may I tell you thank you and that I love you. But there's somebody else whose love makes what I say seem so, and in fact is, so inadequate, so superficial, so fleeting, so temporary. Human love, love that we have for each other, even the ties that bind us together spiritually, can sometimes be a very uncertain thing, can't it? And ties that we think are so strong and so permanent have a way of disappearing. People we thought we'd never be separated from are separated from us. People we thought we would be around forever are gone. That makes the love of Jesus Christ something very special. Here's somebody who loved us so much that in his innocence and in his essential goodness, it was so overwhelming and so transparent and so blindingly brilliant that a world that was so enshrouded in the blackness of its own self-absorbed, sinful, wretched self, that it was so blinded and offended by the blinding light of His love that it could not tolerate it and would not have it and had to stamp it out. Please understand, my good young people, my family, that we have to appreciate and encourage and love and support each other in the faith because we live in a world that does not love truth, that does not appreciate faith, and does not support the most powerful thing of life that's going to heaven. Remember what Jesus said when He sent His disciples out. He said, they will hate you for my name's sake. But remember, He told them, they hated me before they hated you. When you are tempted to become discouraged, the world just doesn't seem to appreciate what you're trying to do and what you're trying to be. And that starts to rob you of your faith and to fill your mind with doubt and discouragement. Will you please remember that the one human being that has tread on this earth that was all that love is, who embodied goodness and decency and honor and compassion and tolerance and patience and kindness and love and joy beyond measure, incalculable, inexpressible. The world so hated that they killed it. How can we be so arrogant, my family, as to expect the world to appreciate and love us because of what we're trying to do? We do not do what we do because people thank us for it and like us for it. And if that's what you're here for somebody to like you and thank you, well, you have gotten your reward. But the world outside is not going to thank you. There are truth seekers out there. There are people who are looking. And you never know who they are. Never know. In 1969, I saw the most beautiful young thing I've ever seen standing in front of me at the band, Berry High School, Birmingham, Alabama. That long, dark hair. I thought that's just the finest thing I'd ever laid his eye on, Connor. And I asked her to go out on a date for me. For 5 consecutive weeks, I took no. I was either really persistent, greatly in love, or the stupidest 16-year-old male that has ever existed. I did not understand that she really wasn't interested. She finally said yes. Within a couple of dates, we started talking about spiritual things. And for 34 years, she's helped me get to heaven. Because she was seeking the truth. And she'll tell you, I don't know, who understands the mysteries of the providence of God? But she'll tell you, God is providence. Brought us together in a time in her life when she desperately was wanting the truth. Truth shall set you free. I am not ashamed of the gospel of Jesus Christ, for it is the dynamite, the power of God for salvation. We understand dynamite. That's what that Greek word is. When truth meets a truth seeker, it is dynamite. And you never know who that person is with whom you're in contact who's looking for the truth. May God help each of us in this building to have the truth with us in our hearts, in our minds, and in our lives. So that his dynamite can bring one more person home to their family. Jesus may have existed as a man, but if that's the end of the story, we're wasting our time, aren't we? If all he was another itinerant preacher among many, many itinerant preachers walking in this forsaken backwater of the Roman Empire that came and went and were forgotten, flashes in the pan. And then as Paul the Apostle said, we are among all men most to be pitied, that we have devoted our lives to somebody who was just another man. Let's talk about that. As we said in our last lesson, Satan spends very little time attacking the reality of Jesus. But he spends a lot of time attacking his divinity. Just as he spends only a little bit of time attacking the existence of God, but he spends a lot of time trying to convince us that he is not good. When Satan appeared in the Garden of Eden, did you notice that Satan did not try to convince Adam and Eve that God didn't exist? Did you notice that? He didn't say, why are you wasting time obeying a God that doesn't even exist? Why, there's no God. But what did he try to convince Eve of? That God was selfish? That God was mean? Why, God doesn't want you to partake of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, because if you do, you'll become like him. And your eyes will be opened. He doesn't want you to be like him. He wants it all to himself. You have a right to that fruit. Look how delicious it is. He doesn't want you to taste something delicious. He attacked the goodness of God, and it worked. Satan attacks the divinity of Christ And all too often, it works. Outside of second, beside rather, to the question of what if there is no God, I think Caiaphas asked the other most profound question that could pass a human lip. And that is, are you the Christ, the Son of God? Now, Caiaphas was not interested in the truth, was he? It was right there before him. Had been there for 3 years. He asked the question superficially. We need to ask it in profundity. Is this man Jesus also the Christ, the Son of God? Here's what I'd like for you to take a little bit of time to do. I want you to get in your groups of four that you've had before or different ones, since you may be sitting differently. I want you to look at these passages, and I want you to come up with as many claims that Jesus made about himself as you can come up with. You have about, I'm going to give you 120 seconds to do this. So get out your Bibles, turn to Mark 14, John 10, John 8, Exodus. And you've got to have to put John 8 together with Exodus 3. And then look at Matthew 14. And I want you to come up with as many things as this man Jesus said about himself as you possibly can. You have 120 seconds. Do we understand the assignment? Very good. You may begin. I'd take my group, I'd assign one person look at one passage, another person look at the other passage, a third person look at the third passage, and a fourth person in your group look at the fourth passage, and then pool your thoughts. Point a spokesman and be ready to come up with your answer. Well, you got to say 50 minutes worth of stuff in 20 minutes, you got to do something. All right, here we go. When you said, he said, are you the Christ? The Christ means the anointed one. And where do we find any information about the anointed one? And what is the Hebrew word for Christ? You remember? Messiah. So he not only claimed to be the Son of God, he also claimed to be the Messiah, the fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy. So he claimed to be Son of God. He claimed to be the fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy to be the Messiah. Yes, sir. He claimed to be the Good Shepherd. Yes, sir. He claimed to be the door. What about John 10:9? Is that what you got from that one? What else did you get from John 10:9? What was he the door to? What did he claim he did for the world? He was going to save the world. He claimed to be the Son of God. He claimed to be the fulfillment of the promised Messiah of Old Testament Scripture. He claimed to be the Savior of the whole world. What about John? You put together, and that's really John 8:58, not 5:58. John 8:58 and Exodus 3:14, this really riled his listeners or got their attention and really stirred them up. What was he claiming to be when you put together John 8:58, not 5:58, and Exodus 3:14? And who is the I Am? God. Jesus claimed to be deity. Before Abraham was, I Am. And then we go to Exodus 3:14. The only other being that ever claimed to be I Am was God Himself. John chapter 1, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Then we keep reading in John chapter 1, we find that the Word is Jesus Christ. So what John chapter 1 is saying is exactly what is said in these two passages, that Jesus claimed for himself, I am God. What was he worthy of? This might have been a little tricky on this, because in here it says, you are the Son of God. Now understand that. But what were they doing when they fell down and said, you are the Son of God? What were they doing to him that was pretty amazing that any human being would allow somebody to do? They were worshiping him. And he let them do it. He didn't say, oh, whoa, 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 whoa. No, I'm just a man. You know, that happened later in the book of Acts. Was it Paul and Silas when they performed some miracles in the book of Acts and they came down and worshiped as if they're God? Saying, no, I'm just a man. Get up. Peter had the same problem. Stand up, for I too am a man. Jesus never said that. When people fell down to worship him, he let them do it because he claimed to be God. He claimed to be the Son of God. He claimed to be the promised Messiah. He claimed to be worthy of worship. Now, Suppose somebody comes in to this building and says, "Hello, I'm the Son of God. Hi, I'm God. Hello, you may fall down and worship me now. Because before Abraham was, I am." What would be our response to that person? "They're coming to take you away, ha-ha. They're coming to take you away, ho-ho, ha-ha. To the funny farm where life is lovely all the time." But people say about this man, "Oh, well, I don't believe he was the Son of God. And I don't believe he was deity. And I certainly don't believe he was just a good man." Well, he was more than a good man. He was a wise teacher. He said a lot of wise things. Or he was a prophet. In fact, that's some of the things that were being said about Jesus. You remember Matthew chapter 16? "Whom do men say that I am?" he asked his apostles. "And some say you're Elijah, some say you're a prophet." But then he asked them, "But who do you say that I am?" And Peter said, "You are the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of God." Well, let me tell you something. There's only really three options to somebody who claims to be God, who claims to be the Son of God, who claims to be the Messiah, who claims to be worthy of our worship. He is either a contemptible liar. That's one option. Jesus was lying when he said, "I was the Son of God." And if he was a liar, if Jesus was saying things, my family, that he knew weren't true, was he a good man? Was he a wise man? No. And was he a prophet of God? He is not. He could not possibly be any of those things if he was saying things that he knew was a liar. Now let's ask that question. One of the options about these claims about Jesus Christ is that he was a liar. Now let me ask you a question. The principal calls you into his office. You've been running around telling everybody that you're the one that scrawled the dirty stuff on the bathroom wall. Now, you really didn't. You just, for some twisted reason, thought that would make you a hero to all your buds. And you knew it really wasn't so. But the principal has heard that you've been running around saying, "I'm the one who did it." And so he gets you into his office and he sits you down and he says, "Did you do this? You know, you did this, and now you're going to be suspended for 436 consecutive days and beaten for doing this. Are you going to skip? Are you going to sit and say, 'Yeah, I did it'? What are you going to do?" "I didn't do it. I just made it all up." Of course, you're going to have a hard time convincing me now, aren't you? But if Jesus were lying about, he was crucified for claiming to be God. Does it make one particle of sense that here is a man who allowed himself to be beaten, scourged, spat on, hauled through the streets of Jerusalem to the derision of howling mobs, have nails driven through his wrists, driven through his feet, hoisted up on a cross, stabbed to the side with a spear, and hang there for 3 days for a crime that he knew he wasn't guilty of? And all he had to do, because that's what Caiaphas wanted to say, when Caiaphas said, "Are you the Christ, the Son of God?" he would have avoided the whole thing by saying what? "No, I made it all up. I'm really not." Does it make sense to say that he's a liar? No. Make any sense at all? Well, then he was a lunatic. Just like a minute ago, what do we say about somebody who claims to be God? Well, you know, he wasn't lying about it. He just thought he was. There are people who have what they call messianic complexes today. And they are, and the loony bins, the psychiatric wards are full of people who have Christ complexes and messianic, who think they're God. That's where we put people. Yeah, well, if he was a lunatic, was he wise? If he was insane, was he a prophet? Did God use insane people as his prophets for his messages? Let me give you another thing. You ever seen some of the stuff Jesus had to say? "Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are the meek. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled." "Bless those that curse you. Do good unto those who despise you. Pray for those who despitefully use you. The Sermon on the Mount are not the ravings of a babbling lunatic. Does it make sense to say that he was a liar? Doesn't make any sense. Nobody dies for something they know isn't true. Does it make sense that he was just crazy, self-deluded, a nutball? Nutballs don't talk like this man spoke. What was it? Even his enemy said, no man spoke like this man. There's only one other option, and what is it? He was either a liar or he was a lunatic. There's one more option. He was exactly what he said he was. Now, what evidence do we have that that's so? We're going to wrap up by looking at the evidence. Besides, just by process of logical elimination, why it's an inescapable conclusion that he was exactly what he claimed to be. Now, what could we argue for Jesus as being God? Well, he did lots of miracles. Does that make him God? Is that proof that he's God? Why not? I see you shaking your head. He raised people from the dead. Does that make him God?
Proves that he was saying was true. Proved that God gave his sample.
Proved he had some supernatural power, but does it prove that he's God? If performing miracles, healing the sick, the lame, the blind, prove that you're God, who else was God in the New Testament? All the apostles, because they did the same thing. If raising somebody from the dead proves that you're God, Paul did the same, or Peter did the exact same thing in the book of Acts. Well, there's really only one thing, and here it is. There's only one thing. Guys, if this is true, then he's God. If it isn't true, then he's not. And don't, when you get in a discussion, don't get sidetracked. It all boils down to this. If Jesus of Nazareth came out of the grave after 3 days of being dead, then he is God. And if he didn't, then he is not. It's that simple. So when we're looking at the evidence that argues in favor of the lordship, the deityship of Jesus of Nazareth, then what we're really talking about is arguments for the resurrection. Let's take a look at that very quickly. There are two anti-resurrection arguments. One's called the swoon theory. Anybody know what a swoon is? Huh? He didn't actually die. What did he do? He swooned. Meaning what? He just passed out. He just fainted. And that's the theory. And so the theory is, and I want you to follow this then carefully. So Jesus, after being up all night, dragged through the courts, first of Herod, and then of the Sanhedrin, and then Herod, and back to the Sanhedrin, and then to Pilate, up all night long, and then after being beaten to within an inch of his life with a terrible scourge, you saw the movie The Passion of Christ, a very accurate depiction of what happened to Jesus, based on my best understanding of what the scriptures say. After being beaten for hours and hours, stabbed with a spear, and hanging from a cross for an entire day, then Jesus woke up, pushed aside a one-ton stone, overpowered two armed guards, and walked away. He just fainted. He got really, really tired, and he hurt really, really bad. And after being in a tomb for 3 days, after being beaten, crucified, he woke up, pushed aside the stone, knocked out two armed Roman guards, and there he was. Here I am. That makes sense to you? Me either. What makes sense? The swoon theory does not make sense. Here's the other theory. The stolen body theory. Now that ought to be familiar to you if you're familiar with the New Testament at all, because this was the first theory advanced by whom? Exactly. Jesus' enemies, the Pharisees, this is exactly what they tried to say. They were very, very afraid that he was going to do this. That's why they wanted Pilate to station two guards in front of the stone, in front of the tomb, lest his disciples come and steal away the body and claim he was resurrected like he predicted he would be. And in fact, in that same passage, we find later on in chapter 28 that that's exactly what his enemies tried to claim happened anyway. There's a couple of problems with that. Let's look at this logically. If his disciples stole his body out of the tomb, and then claimed that he was resurrected. Then, just like we did on what if there is no God, if there is no God, then. If the body was stolen, then, by his disciples, then the disciples died for something that they knew was a lie. We're right back where we started. Why would these disciples run around and let themselves be beheaded and thrown in jail for preaching something that they knew they had concocted out of whole cloth? Does that make sense? That makes no sense. If the body was stolen by the disciples, then the disciples had to know in advance that the resurrection was going to happen. They had to plan it out. But the problem is, not only did they not know he was going to be raised, the scriptures say they didn't even believe he had been raised after it happened. They had to be convinced. We have several passages that if we wanted, really ought to take time. John chapter 20, verse 1, his own female disciples went to the tomb not to steal his body, but to do what to it? To finish embalming it. They went to dress the body. They weren't expecting him to be resurrected. They expected the body to still be there. Peter and John came running up there, not to steal the body, but because the women were claiming he was resurrected, they didn't believe it. Peter had to go in and look in the tomb himself to be convinced that it wasn't there. They had no idea. We have the story of doubting Thomas. He says, unless I put my hands into his very wounds, I won't believe he was resurrected. And in Luke chapter 24, we have a series of vignettes, of little snapshot pictures of various disciples who are very discouraged and very disheartened over the death of the man that they had been following. They say, oh, it's all over. It's done. This man that we were so excited about, well, they've killed him, and now we just don't know. We're all so discouraged. They have no idea. So, the stolen body theory. Makes sense to you? Doesn't make sense to anybody else, really. Well, that leaves us with one conclusion. That is the conclusion that I am who I am. It's the only conclusion that makes any sense, guys. It is supported by credible witnesses, as we have already seen in an earlier lesson, by people who were there and who saw it. It makes sense of and gives value to our lives. For God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son, that whoever would believe in Him should perish. Should not perish, but have everlasting life. In 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verses 54 through 56, Paul said that if Jesus is not raised from the dead, then we're all wasting our time, and we are above all people most to be pitied. What a waste of time we have engaged in our whole lives if we are serving a God who could be defeated by a sword or a spear or some nails and a piece of wood. Jesus Christ, He rose from the dead. He's not a liar. He's not a nut. He's God. But He is a God who loved me so much He was willing to put Himself in my place. I have spent a lifetime loving young people. I make my living working with middle school age youngsters. I just think it's just great. It's just something I can hardly wait to get to every day. And I've told you what an encouragement you have been to me today. But let me assure you that if you were guilty of something, I would not substitute my son Nathan or my son Patrick. I want to say now, yeah, you're a great, and I like you so much. You've been such a great guy, and I've enjoyed knowing you so much. I'll tell you what, instead of you being killed for this crime, you step aside. Nathan, come on over here. Perfectly innocent, I want you. I'm going to sit here, and I'm going to watch you tortured, and watch you be tortured to death and brutally murdered in place of this person. Because I just love him so much. John 3:16 flows so glibly over our lips so often, does it not? For God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son. For God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son. For God so loved the world. And He wasn't talking about Mother Earth. He was talking about you and me. He allowed His own Son to be massacred. And He stood by and watched while His own Son looked up into the heavens. I can't imagine what that must be like. God sitting in heaven with all the power at His disposal to rescue His Son, to stop it all, to reach down and annihilate the Pharisees and the Roman guards sitting at the foot of His cross, cursing and making fun of Him, blaspheming, coming streaming out of their mouths. And my own innocent Son looks up into my eyes and says, my God, why hast Thou forsaken me? God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son. Whoever believes in Him should not perish but have everlasting life. I don't love anybody that much. But I serve someone who does. You join me. And I know that you do, praising a God for giving us the privilege and opportunity of serving and being adopted into the family of a Lord that loves me that much. Giving up a Saturday is a lot, but He gave up His Son to give us the opportunity to give up our Saturday. Take the strength that you gain from each other, the wisdom you drink in from His Word, the encouragement you have gained by the association with others, with each other, and go into a world that will hate you. And resent you. And make fun of you. And try to find that one person who wants to. That you give it to them. The person designated leads in prayer, please do that at this time.